Well, turn back, if you would, to Psalm 64 that we're looking at there this evening. Psalm 64 in God's words. I wonder what you thought as you heard the psalm read and heard the psalm and we sang the psalm. It's a little strange, don't you think? It's not quite some of our usual hymns, is it? To have all these verses, either there in the psalm or here in this paraphrase, about the wicked and their schemes. It's a little strange to sing that, isn't it, perhaps? Maybe it feels a little awkward to us. It's not perhaps the usual sort of thing to sing quite as much about the bad guys and their wicked ways and God's judgment that comes upon them. But hopefully as we look at this psalm together and see something of David's situation and others in the Bible, hopefully that will sort of breathe that life into that psalm that's there as the Holy Spirit helps us understand it. We've got this prayer that David brings. Hear my voice, O Lord. He begins, in my meditation, preserve my life from fear of the enemy. It's an earnest, or as we have in our paraphrase, an anguished prayer that David brings. We're told it's a psalm that he wrote there in the first verse. And so the first thing we see is David under attack. And he prays to God earnestly, knowing that that's his only hope. Hear my prayer, O Lord, O God. Not implying that God doesn't hear, but of course, it's just that earnest pleading. Please, God, listen to this. Preserve my life. He then says in verse 1, preserve my life. So, presumably, David's life, his very existence, is under threat. Hide me, he goes on in verse 2, from the secret plots of the wicked. I need your hiding place. We had more of that in the previous psalm of David talking about hiding under the shadow of God's wings. And here we ask God again to hide him from these secret plots he was facing. In verse 1 as well, it's not just preserve my life, but preserve my life from fear. So again, we can surmise from this that the situation David was facing was one that he was finding very frightening and was very afraid of. He prays, preserve my life, not just preserve my life, but preserve my life from fear of the enemy. So David was there experiencing these troubles of one sort or another. What's going on here in this psalm? He thinks of these secret plots, verse 2, these rebellious plans that are made. Again in verse 2. In verse 3, he has lots of words to talk about weapons. He talks about the sword and the bows and arrows. But all the time, he's actually talking about words, isn't he? Do you see that in verse 3? Who sharpen their tongue like a sword and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, which are bitter words. And so he's using this military language, but it seems perhaps David wasn't under physical attack. He was under these verbal attacks. And these people are using their tongues like swords. And they're shooting bitter words. And those can be just as harmful, can't they? David talks about these enemies. They're the ones who are shooting, verse 4, at the blameless. Those who don't deserve it. And they're being shot at. Carries on, verse 5, they're the ones who lay their traps, lay their snares. Secretly. And they seem to have an arrogance about it too. They don't fear. Verse 4, unlike David, who wants God to protect him from fear, and these blameless people, verse 4, who are being shot at. Well, these enemies, these evil workers, they're not afraid of anything, it seems. And they're quite arrogant and proud of their wickedness. In verse 6, they say, we've perfected a shrewd scheme. They've been working hard on this wickedness. They've been thinking it through and gone to great effort and thought. And now they're very pleased with the result. Our wicked scheme is perfect, they say. We are totally going to get away with this. There's not a chance. This is going to fail. It's their master plan that they have concocted for themselves. As they say in verse 5 at the end, Who will see them? Who will see these snares? Who will see us? Who will see these plans that we've made? We're invincible, aren't we? Stop at like the classic scene in most Bond movies, or, you know, whenever there's an arch villain and everything's been building up right to the end. And the hero's probably been caught by now and is brought before the arch-villain, who declares their wonderful, perfect scheme to take over the world. It's the classic in every movie, isn't it? And why do they do it? They go and tell everyone their perfect scheme to take over the world, right in front of the person who's trying to stop them. And of course there'll be some twist in the plan, in the movie or whatever it is, to allow those schemes to be brought down. But here are these arch-villains in the Bible, and they've got their scheme, and they're convinced no one can possibly stop them. Who will see us? Maybe even implying God himself. No, God himself can't do anything to stop us here. And David concludes, end of verse 6, but the inward thought and the heart of a man are deep. Probably meaning in that, deep in terms of the depths man will sink to. The dark depths of wickedness, as we had in our paraphrase, how devious is the human mind, how dark and deep the human heart. That seems to be what's implied, perhaps, in those verses there. So when David writes this, we don't know for certain. It seems perhaps most likely that it happened early on, before there's too many physical attacks. David's really concentrating really on the verbal attacks, isn't he? And maybe that came earlier on in his conflicts with Saul, in the book of 1 Samuel, for example, chapter 18. There's this resentment beginning to build up between Saul, who's beginning to be jealous of David. And in 1 Samuel chapter 18, we read verse 9, so Saul eyed David from that day onwards. Verse 12, Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him. And all Israel loved David, verse 16. And Saul's perhaps one of the people in mind who's scheming against him. In 1 Samuel chapter 19, verse 1, it carries on, now Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted in David and spoke up for him. And so Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan and swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. But it seems to then carry on. So maybe there's not these direct attacks as yet, but maybe Saul himself is scheming about ways to bring David down. There's one later on when Saul thinks of this idea to try and get David to marry his daughter, and hopes that by doing this, David's going to antagonize the Philistines. It's something nice again in chapter 18. So there are these schemes that are going on. Maybe as well, in the end, Saul almost distances himself from Jonathan, but he knows Jonathan's trying to protect David. And so maybe some of Saul's schemes are even more sort of underhand. And maybe David doesn't know who's on Saul's side. Which of Saul's henchmen have traps and things like that in mind against him? Maybe there were those that Saul had sought to try and find out, to try and throw accusations at David, or to try and talk evil about David and the like. And maybe there would be others who would just be opportunistic and see that, you know, if they did something against David, well, they'd win some favours with Saul. Or maybe they'd take matters into their own hands. There they are. It's hard to tell exactly when these things happen in the life of David, but David is facing this distressing situation. But we see here in this psalm as well David's confidence in God. That's why he makes his prayer in the first place, isn't it? Hear my voice, O God, in my meditation, preserve my life from fear of the enemy. He comes and prays to God, asking God to preserve him, to keep him safe from these attacks, to deliver him from fear. Maybe being afraid of these people was keeping him up at night and giving him nightmares or making him anxious all the time. Preserve me from fear too, O God. And he's confident that God will act. So verses 2 to 6 talk about these evil men and their schemes. And then verse 7 changes abruptly, doesn't it? But God will do something. David was sure that God would act and that God will come to his defense and help him in this situation. So verse 7, but God shall shoot at them with an arrow. Surely they shall be wounded. And David sees in this a sort of a justice in that as well. Remember in verse 3, they're the ones who are shooting words like arrows. And David knows there will be a time when there will be justice. And God will shoot his arrows. And they'll be wounded when God acts against them. Same in verse 8. So he'll make them stumble over their own tongue. And again, that word tongue had come up before in verse 3, hadn't it? They sharpen their tongue like a sword. And now David says, and there'll come a time when God will make them stumble over their own tongue. David sees a justice in what God will do, how God will undermine their schemes and their plans, and the very things they try to do will be the things that come round and bite them, as it were. And their arrows they try and shoot, well, God will shoot them. And their wicked schemes they come, and the things they want to do with their tongue as they spread these evil words about David, well, they'll stumble over their own tongue, says David. That's what God will do. God will act. God will intervene. He's confident in God and in his justice. And then thirdly, we see him glorifying God right at the end. All who see will flee away, end of verse 8. All men shall fear. When God acts, and when God intervenes in bringing down these evil schemes and stopping these people with their plans, when God does intervene and act, David says, well, everyone's going to flee. Everyone's going to fear. People are going to think about consequences of their actions when they see these people get their just desserts. Everyone else is going to be brought into a fear of God. Everyone else is going to be aware of what's happening, and they'll declare the work of God, middle of verse 9. Everyone's going to see this happen, and they know it's going to be God's doing that has caused this to happen. And God's people then will wisely consider his doing, God's doing. The righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in him, and the upright in heart shall glory. So when God acts and when God intervenes, all people are going to fear God. And God's people are going to glorify him. They're going to see him doing these things, and the upright in heart shall glory. And they're going to be glad in the Lord and trust in him. So we've been thinking through this short little psalm, only 10 verses, thinking about David and his experience. Then there's not a huge amount to go on in the stories of 1 and 2 Samuel, when this occasion might be. And how we have this Psalm of David, talks about the wicked, talks about him being under attack, but he's confident in God and looks to God to help in this situation and looks to glorify God as well. It's one of those psalms, as we said, it's a little bit strange as we read it, and perhaps even more so in its singing. But just the way we sort of think, this isn't quite like a hymn we normally sing, to spend quite so much time talking about the wicked and their schemes. And perhaps we feel a little bit awkward too in some of the ways that David sort of expresses this. And David asks God to defend him, well, that sounds okay, but by defending him to attack his enemies. And in the paraphrase we sang, but God will take them by surprise. Their bodies will be stricken, torn, destroyed by their recoiling lies, and all who look on them with scorn. It's not quite the way you normally sing, is it? And perhaps it seems a little awkward. But it's important to see in it that this isn't David seeking revenge. It's not that David's going to do anything against these people who are planning evil. He's confident in God's justice. We could look at it as well, as we've done in other weeks. We thought of David's psalm. And secondly, we could sort of think as well then of it being Israel's psalm, as we work through these steps in other weeks. And there are those times, aren't they, thinking about the life of Israel in the Old Testament, when God does dramatically intervene against his enemies. Perhaps one of the classic examples is Pharaoh, isn't it, in Egypt. And God brings deliverance for his people, the people of Israel, and defeat for Egypt. And they've concocted their schemes, and Pharaoh comes out with his army to recapture the Israelites as they're leaving after the Passover, as they're leaving the land of Egypt, heading on their way to freedom. And Pharaoh and his army come straight after, don't they? And he's convinced no one can stop him. And Pharaoh charges after them. We thought about it a little bit, the Boys Brigade camp, and how God then makes the path through the Red Sea. And the Israelites walk through the Red Sea knowing that their God has made this path for them. In a sense, you wonder what went into Pharaoh's mind as he approached the Red Sea and saw a path through it that the Israelites were walking. Did he not think to himself, well, the God of the Israelites has done this? He seems to recklessly pursue them straight down into the Red Sea, doesn't he? And there he's destroyed, he and his army. And God's people hear of it and rejoice, don't they, on the shores of the Red Sea afterwards. But a little bit like here in this psalm, all who see this will flee away and all men shall fear. Later in the story, in the book of Joshua, the people arrive on the borders of the promised land and the spies go in, you might know the story, and they meet Rahab. And Rahab tells them the story she's heard. Joshua chapter 2 verse 9. She says, I know the Lord has given you this land, and the terror of you has fallen on us, and all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you, because we've heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. As soon as we heard these things, our heart melted. Neither there did remain any more courage in anyone because of you, because of the Lord your God. He is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. So people saw what happened to Pharaoh. And all the people in the lands around fear the Lord. And Rahab herself sees something of his glory and realizes that he's the only true God and comes to him and begins to trust in him, doesn't she? A bit like it's got here at the end of the psalm. God does do this. And we see it there in the Old Testament, don't we, as well? So David wrote this psalm. And it becomes part of the hymn book of the Jewish people, the Israelite people there in the Old Testament. And there must have been times that they sang this psalm and echoed its words. Perhaps we might be able to think of a few occasions where it kind of fits. Another one from our Boys Brigade camp might be the story of Daniel himself. Daniel was somebody who was an innocent man who faced the wicked schemes of others, didn't he? And there were those who went to the king, didn't they? And they wanted Daniel done away with because he was becoming too popular, too successful. They wanted his position. And so they went to the king and made him make this ridiculous law about praying only to the king. Whoever didn't would be thrown in the lion's den. That's their wicked scheme, isn't it? That's their words, their tricks. They think no one's going to see through this. The king won't. He doesn't until it's too late. And there they've got this perfect scheme in place. Daniel's thrown in the lion's den. They've won, they think. Kind of seems a little bit like this psalm, doesn't it? But God delivers. Maybe Daniel sang this psalm, facing execution in the lion's den, even though he hadn't done anything wrong. And of course, it does happen a little bit like it says in this psalm. God will shoot at them with an arrow, and God will make them stumble over their own tongue. And so for those people who made that evil law to trick the king to throw Daniel in the lion's den, they're the ones who are thrown in the lion's den themselves, aren't they? Their wicked scheme comes back to bite them, literally, in their heads. And that's what happens. God's justice that he works round. Perhaps even better example in the Old Testament would be that in the book of Esther and Haman. And Haman perhaps is the one more than anyone in the Old Testament of these enemies of the land of Israel, who's the one who uses his words. And he devises this scheme, doesn't he? How he's going to have Mordecai put to death, and he's going to have this opportunity for the Jews in exile to be massacred. This Haman's cunning plan. He's got all the power. He's got the king doing whatever he says. It all seems perfect. And then, of course, through God and through Esther's courage and so on, God turns it completely upside down, and Haman's hung on the gallows that he built to hang someone else on. It's the way that God turns things round, we might say, almost in the nick of time, just at the last minute. God's the one who dramatically intervenes. And so we see this psalm being fulfilled and maybe being sung by God's people as they face these kind of situations there in the Old Testament, and how God did intervene to preserve his people and to preserve them from fear. And he hid them from the secret plots of the wicked, just like David prays and, in a sense, probably prophesies in this psalm as well. So we thought of it as David's psalm, we thought of it as Israel's psalm. And perhaps some of those situations brings a little bit of life to this psalm in some ways too. Third step then is to think of it as being Jesus's psalm. As we thought of those Old Testament characters, David and Daniel, the Israelites escaping from Egypt, and Mordecai and Esther and the like. When we think of someone who is blameless, verse 4, and is shot at, those who are around him were these workers of iniquity, rebelling, sharpening their tongue like a sword. There is almost a sort of prophetic sense to this psalm as well, isn't there? That the person who it's really true of, who really did face this kind of hostility, was Jesus himself, wasn't it? And there he was, Jesus, speaking these wise, kind, gracious words. And all around him are people plotting together his downfall. And we see it in the New Testament, don't we? In the Gospels, of how the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who didn't get on about anything, suddenly they managed to cooperate in concocting evil schemes. And they come to Jesus with one tricky question after another, hoping to get him in trouble with the people or in trouble with the Romans or whatever it is, asking questions about taxes and asking questions about tricky doctrines and whatever. They're trying to trap him every single day, it seems. He's the blameless one who's constantly being shot at by their bitter words, their tempting, their deceits, constantly trying to get Jesus to say the wrong thing. And Jesus, the one who's so gracious with them, and perhaps in some ways fulfilling a little bit of this psalm, but also in another way turning it round. Jesus dies for these. He dies for these Pharisees and Sadducees and the rest. And we even see in the book of Acts how at least we're told at least about some of the priests. We know one particular Pharisee, come back to him in a minute, who come to faith in Jesus. Those who've been out to get him in the first place are come to be forgiven by him in the end. Another application for Jesus, of course, is that we see in this psalm not just the attacks of people against Jesus, but we see the attacks of Satan, don't we? And if there's one person in the Bible who's described like this, it is Satan himself, isn't it? We read in the New Testament of the one who fires his fiery darts, Satan who prowls round like a roaring lion. And we see that in the life of Jesus, that yes, there were the traps of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the rest, but these were all part of Satan's traps, weren't they? And we see Satan tempting Jesus in the desert with his cunning words, sometimes turning Bible verses into attacks himself upon Jesus. We see his cunning words, his sort of secret snares that he's laying for Jesus, how he schemes against him. And his deceitful plan just goes on and on, doesn't it, through the Gospels. And at one glance, it seems to triumph, doesn't it? Isn't that what the cross is on one level? It is Satan's perfect scheme. Like here in these verses. And Satan's managed to get all of these pieces in motion. He's tempted the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the priests and the rest. He's tempted Judas to betray him. Everything's going Satan's way, we might think. He's got everything together. Jesus is handed over to the Sanhedrin and the like. They sentence him to death. A Pilate tries to have him released. The crowd shout, "No, crucify him." And it's all going Satan's way. He's managed to get the Jews to reject their own Messiah. He's got them to cooperate with the Romans, who are the ones with the authority to put Jesus to death. He has Jesus executed, nailed to a cross. Of course, being nailed to a tree was a sign of God's curse. It's all perfectly working for Satan, isn't it? Until, a little bit like this psalm, God makes them stumble over their own schemes. And Satan, who's done all of this, then of course, Jesus breathes his life, his Christ, it is finished. Even in that moment, the temple curtains ripped open and things like that. And of course, 3 days later, he rises again. And Satan's master plan is triumphed over. And all the things that stood against us, the law, it's nailed to the cross. And Satan is ridiculed there. Because Jesus dies, that perfect man who didn't deserve to die. He dies in the place of sinners. And then he rises again, defeating death, defeating Satan, defeating everything in Satan's scheme. And so we see, in another sense, a little bit of a prophetic side to this psalm. Jesus, the one who's under attack. And Jesus, the one who brings triumph over his enemies. And so Jesus, the one, in some ways, who this psalm refers to even more. And as we think, lastly then, the last step, we thought of it David's psalm, Israel's psalm, Jesus' psalm, our psalm. You see, that's why we have to do these steps, because if we just jump straight in with us, perhaps the psalm seems a bit too weird. But once we've done a little bit of legwork, we can come then to us and say, well, actually, perhaps we can sing this psalm in a way, and perhaps we can pray this psalm, mostly perhaps following that application we just had with Jesus. That Jesus' biggest enemy, of course, was Satan. Not the people around him, but Satan. And so it is for us. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against Satan and those forces of wickedness. And we are the ones, a little bit like then in this psalm, who are under attack from the evil one. Who's the one who sharpens his tongue like a sword and shoots his arrows that are bitter words? That's Satan most of all, isn't it? He's the biggest threat we face, not other people really, although sometimes they may be antagonistic and they may be horrible in the things they say, but Satan's the one who fires his fiery darts against us. And we're told, aren't we, in the New Testament, to take up the full armour of God and to stand firm and to pray, aren't we, in Ephesians 6? To take up the armour of God and pray. And pray a psalm like this: "Hear my voice, O Lord, in my meditation. Preserve my life from fear of Satan. Hide me from the secret plots of him, from the rebellion of his workers of iniquity." He's the one who sharpens his tongue like a sword. He's the one who's launching his temptations and attacks against me. He's the one who wants to make me doubt. He's the one who's shooting at me and has no fear himself. God, you're the one who needs to protect me. Preserve my life. Keep me safe from fear. And may I hide in you. We can pray, in a sense, this psalm too, then, can't we? In our struggle against Satan. And, of course, God's the one who does answer. We can think of it as well, in another sense, of praying, maybe especially for the persecuted church, where they come under particular attacks of Satan. And maybe he uses human beings who lead that persecution, in earthly terms, against God's people, various sorts of dictators, various sorts of leaders in different towns and so on, who are the ones spearheading persecution against God's people. We can pray the same, that God would preserve them from fear of the enemy, that God would keep them safe if it's his will. And perhaps too, that God would shoot at them with an arrow and make them stumble over their own tongue. Because God does that in the New Testament, doesn't he? We mentioned a certain Pharisee, Saul, who's out persecuting the church. And he's got his perfect scheme, hasn't he? He's off to Damascus to arrest more Christians and put them in prison until God shoots at him with an arrow. Verse 7. It's just a little unexpected. What kind of arrow it is? There Saul is on his way to arrest more Christians, and God shoots him down. He's down on his knees. He can't see a thing. He's blinded. And he hears Jesus talking. He's been wounded by God, but wounded in a good way. Because through that experience of meeting God and Jesus revealing himself to Saul, he becomes a changed man. So we can pray, can't we? For those who are under persecution, and we can pray too for their persecutors. That God would, if it's his will, get rid of these persecutors who are oppressing his people. And maybe if it's God's will, then he might shoot them with those arrows of conviction. And that power of his Holy Spirit working in them, that the person they're persecuting, Jesus himself, might reveal himself to them too. We can pray too in our own situations. Maybe we don't face the same sort of intense persecution as in other parts of the world. But perhaps we look around us in our country and see those who shoot words and the lies that are out there and the false teaching of false religions or atheism, its effects in the public sphere, in schools and all kinds of things, the LGBT movement and what have you, all these false teachings that are out there. We can pray too that these things would stumble over their own tongue. These things that have seem so bizarre and seem such a mess of lies that are being shared. We can pray that the lies will unravel. That these false information, this propaganda, this false teaching that's out there, that it will trip over itself. And God will work in different ways as he chooses to do. And so as we've thought about this psalm, it is a psalm we can pray. A psalm we can pray in our fight with the evil one, a psalm we can pray when persecuted, a psalm we can pray for those who are being persecuted and the persecutors too, and that we can pray in our own situation too. And may we have the same confidence in God, that God's the one who will act, and he'll do astonishing things. Get like those stories in the Old Testament of Daniel and Esther and the rescue from Egypt. God does the unexpected, doesn't he? In delivering his people and defeating those plans against them. We can pray and we can have the same confidence in God. And when God acts, as certainly he will, all men will fear and will declare this is the work of God and will consider wise measure their doing. And the righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in him, and all the upright in heart shall glory.